Well, welcome to the Spum Podcast, where every time we have a new guest on, we force them to eat a polar bear's liver. Check your mail.
I don't feel good, guys. Please, can I stop now?
No. Welcome, everybody, to the Has to Do with Spider-Man, I Think podcast. The number one stop for Cheez-It and cheese cracker discussion. And also, in this podcast, we are continuing the Sony Pictures universe of Marvel movies unofficially. Cannot stress that enough. Unofficially.
No, it's official. We have the full backing of Sony.
No, so no, 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 no.
Please, no.
No, no.
Wait.
One script at a time. If you are joining us for the first time today, this is one of our guest episodes. We like to kind of pace ourselves in between episodes with having a guest come onto the pod and give us a little bit of their own flavor and add some more stuff to our growing universe and also multiverse of Marvel movies. Joining us today is a longtime listener and frequent prediction giver. Many of you are probably familiar with their wonderful concepts and commentary in the Dark Universe and Spider-Pod fandom, but recently they have joined this new podcast phenomenon with their own podcast cinematic universe. So I suppose if you would consider Ayadu the parent, you're our sibling of sorts.
Oh. I didn't know what you meant. I've always pronounced it Ayadu in my head.
Ayadu?
I don't know. It's not a real word. It doesn't matter.
True. I've never considered that.
I pronounce it Ayadu.
Okay, that's insane. There's no H at the end.
Noah doesn't listen to the podcast, so his opinion is invalid and doesn't count.
True.
Shame, shame. Anywho, who you just heard is the hoist. The host. The
We're
voice?
Adding H's and I's every into the middle of words that don't exist now.
I know. The host, the voice, and the sole storyteller for the public domain Cinematic Universe podcast, Richard G.
You would probably pronounce it as like Pidaku.
Pidaku. Pidaku.
That's right. Public domain Cinematic Universe. I basically make fan fiction about characters your grandfather would have read about back in the day.
Woo! The public domain always like has piqued my interest, and I know that Jarrett and I, and also Noah, we've talked a little bit about tapping into some of the public domain stuff before, but it's so daunting, especially like the whole sort of legality factor of it. I've listened to your phase one announcement and also the Terror of the Ape Man episode, which I really, really enjoy, and I really recommend everybody listen to them. You're brave AF for going through the long list of public domain characters, because that is so like daunting.
Here's
to
my
me.
Secret is if I accidentally like use a character who still like belongs to a big company, is I'm immune to the law. I challenge any mega corporation to come at me. Like, I will take on any shitheel legal team, including.
No.
You can't sue us for money. We don't have any.
Y'all, no. I'm panicking.
When Andy edits this, I permit them to just like bleep out with like an obnoxiously loud censor.
Valid. So tell us a little bit, or tell the audience a little bit about the premise of the public domain cinematic universe.
Okay, that's really hard to do because I don't know the law good, and I don't know how to explain copyright and IP law to someone, but basically, if a character is in the public domain, I am building out a cinematic universe where I pitch stories. I pick a public domain character, I pitch stories about him, and I build out a cinematic universe one pitch at a time. It's like this podcast. It's just like this podcast. I'm stealing the format. So my phase one characters are Tarzan, Robin Hood, Don Quixote, and Blue Beetle, who people keep telling me isn't public domain, and yes, he is, I think.
There is a Blue Beetle that's public domain, yeah.
No, there's two.
There, yeah. Is Dan Garrett one of them?
Yeah, Darren Garrett came first, and I'm going to get into this in the episode, but Charlton didn't actually like get permission because the company that created Dan Garrett went under, and then they just started publishing Dan Garrett comics, and then they started publishing Ted Kord comics, and they didn't have like a legally binding copyright notice. So then when they sold the Charlton IP to DC, they basically tricked DC into paying like tens of thousands of dollars for characters they could have used at any time. It's awesome.
That's incredible. That's
if you get into like the history of Charlton, they were like so like bare budget and fly by night. It's like inspiring.
That's very, I had no clue about that aspect of the story.
It's a lot of fun.
I think the cool thing about like your podcast in particular is that, and I've thought about this a lot, specifically after I just finished Solo, the potentiality of taking these hour to 3 hour long scripts and then being able to eventually turn them into something original. The public domain cinematic universe is prime for that, because if you wanted to ever turn, say, the Manape story into like an original novel, you can, because they're in the public domain.
To be honest, I would be very scared to, because the Edgar Rice Burroughs estate actually is like vicious. Like, they've sued Disney and won. I do not want to dance with them. They've sued,
holy
like
shit.
As I understand it, they've like sued like fan fiction of Tarzan. Like, they fiercely defend their remaining copyright stuff.
Damn. That's wild. But Robin Hood, people probably wouldn't sue you for Robin Hood.
I mean, I'd like to see them try them and their shitbag legal teams.
Curses. Taking money from the poor.
It kills me so much that like horrible crypto app is called Robin Hood. Like, come on, guys.
Yeah,
they're just the fucking mocking us now, you know?
Yeah.
My favorite is Palantir as the chosen.
Oh my god. How did they get away with that?
I don't know. It's so dumb. And it's like, yeah, let's name this tech company after the all-seeing like weapon of Sauron that corrupts all who look into it.
Holy shit, that's what that means?
The Palantir, you know, in
it's the evil crystal ball, yeah.
What the fuck?
That's really? The Palantir. Yeah.
Oh my god.
Okay, if we keep talking about Palantir, I'm gonna probably say some stuff that Andy's gonna have to beep, so
I'm waiting for a cryptode to drop called just straight up called Skynet. Like, we're breaking all pretense.
I think they actually, someone did file a copyright for that, I think.
Really?
Fuck me, dude.
I think so. Maybe I'm making that up, but
one of my most interesting public domain story things is there's a book that I read that I will save my opinion for to myself.
Oh boy.
Because we ever got this guy on the pod. It's called, I did not like it. It's called Nick. It's about Nick Carraway from The Great Gatsby. It released like literally 4 days after The Great Gatsby entered into the public domain. And it's by Michael Ferris Smith. And I'm a Great Gatsby fan. I of course, we all read it in like high school. Most of us have read it in high school.
I actually didn't read it until 6 months ago.
Damn.
I really loved it, but I have no one to talk about it with. Like, I wanted to discuss the themes. Like, apparently Gatsby's like Jewish in one interpretation. That sounds cool. I don't know.
Oh, that's interesting. Is Great Gatsby coming to the public domain cinematic universe podcast soon?
Here's the thing. I like you guys. I respect you. I'm going to give you a little treat. I want to include Gatsby. I'm struggling on how, because he's like such a iconic character. I want to do him right. If or when he comes, he will be played by Patrick Ball from The Pit.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah.
Oh.
I look at that man and I can like instantaneously picture him in a pinstripe suit.
Valid. That's a good pick.
Thank you. I'm very proud.
I definitely see it.
Right?
The Nick Carraway book really kind of frustrated me, because it's like it follows Nick Carraway during his time in World War One, right before he moves to the West Egg. And it just, I did not care for it. It felt very unnecessary and kind of tangential. But there are other public domain books, like I can't remember who does this, but it'll be like The Great Gatsby, but every other line it's mentioned that Gatsby is taking a hit from his vape. And so it'll be like it'll be the original text of The Great Gatsby, and then at random it'll be like Gatsby took a long drag from his vape and blew a fat cloud.
I almost wonder if that was released before the copyright expired, and that was their way of saying like, no, it's a parody.
Yeah, right. The law is so interesting to me. I make it make sense. I can't. But you are joining us to pitch a public domain character in our Sony Pictures Universal Marvel movies or Spider-Man Cinematic Universe.
Why did you stop calling it the Spunk? I love that.
The Spunk.
Spunk, Sony Pictures Universe of Marvel characters, baby.
Marvel characters.
Yeah, that's what the original thing was when they were like, yeah, we've got our own cinematic universe. It's called the Spunk. And people were
The
like, you
Spunk.
can't call it
Yeah.
that.
We took the Spum from the Weekly Planet. The two Australian podcasters, they James and Mason, whatever they were talking about it, they call it the Spum.
What does that stand for?
The Sony Pictures Universe of Marvel movies.
No, it's
But
Marvel
Spunk.
characters. They're trying to whitewash it. They can't take away our
Spunk.
history.
It's weird because like
It's such a bad
Weekly
name
Planet coined
regardless.
it's so
Weekly
bad.
Planet coined a term for it first, if I recall, and then Sony went, "No, it's called this," and they were like, and the public went, "Guys, that is you. It
Oh, is
sound
that what
no."
happened? Oh.
There is no good way of phrasing it because Marvel movies, Marvel characters, I think they call it the Sony Spider-Man universe is another
Which is
one.
ridiculous because he wasn't in it.
Yeah.
I just love that Sony is so incompetent that they never thought to call it the Spider-Verse.
Yeah, right? Like
Something like
make
that.
a little graphic, you know.
Show a photo of all your main characters for the first phase just sitting in chairs in a gray background. Like
Dark
dark humor.
Universe, baby.
I do find it very, very humorous to me the amount of times that people have attempted a cinematic universe and it just never lands. But Richard, I want to hear your thoughts on the Sony Pictures universe of Marvel characters or Marvel movies.
I think they were generally pretty bad and forgettable. That's
Yeah.
probably not what you want to hear, but
No, we agree.
I mean, I kind of wish they just like thrown canon to the wind and just made like, oh yeah, here's like an Agent Venom movie done by shit, who does like tactical stuff? I want to say David Ayer, but he's not that great. Be
Oh,
like an Agent Venom
yeah.
movie and then do like Spider-Ham that's like animated. Just like have fun with it, guys.
Right,
And instead
right.
they're like, no, we got to green light like a bunch of Madame Web sequels because she's a fan favorite character, of course.
Right.
We have to release Morbius twice.
I think that the thing about it that's very interesting to me is like you said, the easiest route for this is to get various directors to make genre driven movies set across the like Marvel multiverse of sorts. So you do like a body horror thing with like Lee Cronin, for example, or
Ooh,
and
yeah.
it's like Peter Parker's turning into a spider or something. That's what I would think to do if we were to actually completely reboot this, is to do various spider people, and then a phase one conclusion could be like some sort of Spider-Verse thing where everybody kind of meets up in a central point or something. But no, they chose to do Kraven the Hunter.
Actually, wait, I don't think this is technically Spunk, but I did have one opinion on the Sony Spider-Man movies. I really wish Drew Goddard had gotten to do his Sinister Six. He would have killed that man.
Oh
That would have been amazing.
yeah, but the it was like an Amazing Spider-Man sequel, wasn't it?
It was, but like, I feel like he'd be the guy to be like, okay, everything you guys have done is bad, but now I'm gonna do it again, but good. And he'd just kind of fix it.
Yeah, he would throw like a lot of the past setup to the wind and just make a really solid standalone
We
movie.
were talking
Exactly, yeah.
the other day about in The Amazing Spider-Man, because I just watched The Amazing Spider-Man 1 and 2 for the first time about a week ago. And we were talking in call, Jared and I, about it. And I was like, the whole walking through the room of origins is so funny to me. Like, he's just walking through, and there's a very, like, there's the Vulture, there's the Dr. Octopus arms. And it's just like, this is such a terrible setup. I did not like that at all.
The sequel room is one of the funniest bits in that whole series.
I think that we should do it. I genuinely
The
think that,
sequel
like,
room?
yes, by the like for the end of Lethal Protectors 2, and Andy, keep this in, for the end of Lethal Protectors 2, post-credit scene, just hit for phase three, like a guy walking through the room, and it's like, oh, Okay,
No,
cool then.
what you got to do, right, is like either end of phase two or phase three, when it's like the before the big finale, like your Infinity War before your end game, to help like the audience remember who all the characters are. You have a guy walk through like a wall of rooms that have like the supervillain tech in it, but it goes on for like 20 minutes because you have so
Oh
many
my
characters
gosh.
by that point. Like he's just walking in total silence as he passes like the big wheel,
The
the
Swiss
scorpion
Miss.
tail, the Swiss Miss. Yeah, funny you should mention that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh?
Huh?
Oh,
Huh?
she's in my
What?
pitch.
Huh? Well, you know what? Let's get into the pitch. I'm really intrigued by this. Tell us a little bit about this character before we actually dive straight into it. The audience knows that this is the Spider, a pulp character from the pulp age of pulp books.
With
Tell
extra
pulp.
pulp.
And
Stop
more
saying.
pulp. More pork. What? No.
What? Huh?
Nah.
Tell us a bit more about the spider, preferably without using the word pulp four times in one sentence.
First of all, don't tell me what to do.
Valid.
Well, my first idea, I did like think about it because you guys are like much more comedic in tone than my podcast. Part of me really wanted to share a Kazar movie because Kazar is technically in the public domain and just do my Terror of the Ape Man script, but with Kazar, like
Oh my
one to
God.
one. But no, that's the problem. There's not a lot of Marvel characters in the public domain. Like they got their start in the 60s, but DC's way older, so they have a lot more characters who like fall under those rules. So eventually I just gave up and I chose an unrelated character called the Spider, who is a Depression era vigilante. He's almost like explicitly a ripoff of the Shadow. They had to like change a couple of his like character elements later to avoid a lawsuit. But yeah, he's like a the best way I've heard him described is that he's like if the Shadow was a universal monster, kind of.
Ooh.
Okay.
And
Ooh.
unfortunately, a lot of that isn't public domain, so I kind of played fast and loose. You guys might be getting sued by a magazine publisher. Sorry.
Oh. Oh.
Probably not, though.
Oh,
It's fine.
man.
This is parodied. We're gonna have them vaping.
Yes.
Peyton's
All
back on
right.
board with the vaping.
I love vaping.
Hell
Everybody
yeah,
needs to
brother. Let's
vape.
blow some clouds. Popcorn lung
Everybody.
isn't real.
Yes. Y'all all have my permission to start vaping right now.
Thank God. I was waiting for Peyton's permission before I did this.
I'm good.
No one bring out that vape. All righty. Let's dive into it. Let's get into the spider.
Technically it has a full name, which is the Spider Web of Shadows, because I felt weird just calling it the Spider.
Valid.
So I stole the name from a video game my mom didn't let me play when I was a kid. It's
Curse
cool. I'm
is
not mad about
forbidden.
it. It's fine. It's fine. It's fine. All right, fellas, shall we begin?
Indeed.
We shall.
Okay. The Spider Web of Shadows, Act One. We open on a black screen, accompanied by the mournful cry of an expertly played violin. A sudden footfall disrupts the blackness, sending out wide ripples, and as the camera pans out, we see that the blackness was a puddle on a street in New York City around 11 p.m. Right away, we can see that this isn't the usual spunk. The cars and buildings are all from the 20s and 30s, and there's a black and white filter over everything. We're actually in the noir universe, seen briefly in Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. The music swells in intensity, and we pan over to see a street busker pouring his heart into his performance. Though he seems absorbed in his craft, we notice him stealing glances at a man walking in his direction. This is a multiversal variant of Daniel Britto, aka Fancy Dan, played again by Mike Faist. The violinist turns his back to Dan, and when the gangster passes him, he delivers a final sweep of his bow, accidentally jabbing it into Dan's neck.
Watch it, dumbass.
The busker looks up at him with dim eyes, his words slurring slightly. Hey, pal, you almost broke my reed. What are you standing so close to me for? Fancy Dan scoffs.
You poor dumb son of a bitch. Don't you know who I am?
Judging from your height, probably Shirley Temple. Fancy Dan laughs at the man's audacity, running his hand over his mouth before delivering a brutal Taekwondo sidekick, which sends the busker flying into the alley behind him. Dan follows him in, mirthfully cracking his knuckles.
You must have been born yesterday. I don't know why I did that with an accent.
No, it's okay. He probably has a transatlantic accent. Go nuts.
I feel like if I start, I'm not gonna be able to keep it up, so I'm just gonna start with
It's in the noir universe, man. Go ahead.
You must have been born yesterday. No, I'm not.
No, that's perfect. That's perfect. That's how I read it in my head. You have to now.
Fuck. Okay. You must have been born yesterday or something. That's the only explanation I got for why you think it's a good idea to mouth off to one of Hammerhead's enforcers.
Perfect. To his surprise, the busker easily rises to his feet. He must have accidentally rolled with the blow, but he definitely won't be rolling with this next one. Fancy Dan darts forward, turning into a roundhouse kick aimed at the busker's neck. But the busker's hand whips up with lightning speed, grabbing Fancy Dan's ankle and arresting his motion. A follow-up jab, faster than the eye can see, hits Dan in the solar plexus and knocks the wind out of him.
What? What the hell?
The busker's face is hidden in shadow, but he straightens to his full height, becoming unrecognizable. When he speaks, it drips with menace and the promise of brutal violence. I mouthed off to one of Hammerhead's enforcers because I needed information, and you were the easiest to find. Fancy Dan faints before trying to hit his foe with a knee strike. He hits nothing but empty air, and a blow to his lower ribs sends him to the ground. And the easiest to get information out of. All you've got is fancy footwork. He stomps down on Fancy Dan's ankle and grinds his heel, pinning him down while he tries not to scream. I spent a lifetime seeking out monsters and maniacs, learning the best ways to hurt the people who deserve it. I was their pupil and the subject of their finest torment. I was bleeding out in alleys and trying to push my teeth back into my gums while you were wasting your time with this ballerina fit. The busker crouches down, and while his face is still concealed in shadow, one of his eyes is visible. It's as gray and cold and inhuman as the surface of the moon. Fancy Dan is drenched in cold sweat and swallows defiantly.
I won't tell you anything about Hammerhead's operation.
I don't care about Hammerhead. He's small potatoes. I'm looking for a woman. Her name is Molly Lee Dante. She's some sort of witch. Moves metal around with her mind.
Oh, shit.
What makes you think I'd know that?
Hammerhead is paranoid. He keeps tabs on every superpowered villain in the city, and he'd make sure his enforcers knew who to watch out for. Spit it out now. The sodium thiopental should be hitting your bloodstream any minute. We cut to Fancy Dan's neck, and we see there's a faint wound where he was struck with the violin's bow, almost like an injection site. Dan swallows weakly, and his pupils are dilated.
Look, I know the woman you're talking about, but she doesn't have much presence in New York. Only been once or twice that we know about. Look, there's someone else who might know, okay? She's weird, too. Likes magic and masks and stuff. Name's Janine Godby. She'll be attending a party at a hotel on West 42nd Street tomorrow.
Satisfied with Dan's information, the busker stands up, looking down at his fallen opponent with passive gray eyes. Dan bares his teeth in rage.
I told you what you wanted to know, okay? Now quit staring at me, freak. Get lost.
You think sodium thiopental was the only thing I dosed you with? You lived as a criminal. Now you get to die as one. Fancy Dan starts to seize up, and the busker watches emotionlessly as he convulses and foams at the mouth. After several minutes of painful-looking seizing, Fancy Dan finally goes still. The busker reaches into his pocket, disassembling a platinum lighter into a miniature heating coil and pressing it into the dead body's forehead with a sickening hiss. His task complete, he places a wide-brimmed hat over his head and ducks out of the alley. We slowly zoom in on Fancy Dan's forehead and reveal that he's been branded with the image of a spider. The title card appears over top. The Spider, Web of Shadows.
Okay.
This is intriguing. We haven't had, like, a story that's not... Well, okay. We've
Unless
had the Garfield.
Garfield.
Yeah.
No, you're not.
Which, yeah. This is the first genuine attempt at telling a story in an alternate universe of the Spider-Verse, I think.
I, like, played around with the idea of making him, like, a modern, like, contemporary spum character, and it just didn't work. The man's too pulpy. You gotta put him in the 30s where he belongs. He's like a zoo animal.
I like the vibe of making a very Spider-Man noir, which that show's coming out pretty soon, isn't it?
May.
It is.
In May.
And I kind of comment, because the idea is it's the same noir universe that the Nicolas Cage Spider-Man noir is from.
Cool. Yeah, that works. So we didn't really talk about this. Do you have like a director in mind for this?
Oh, I figure since this is like a kind of like neo-noir, or I guess classic noir story, big touching point for me was Darkman, so I think Sam Raimi would be really good for this.
Mm.
Okay, cool. Yep. Yeah, I could see it. I think, so...
We may have actually, this might be a return for Sam Raimi for this universe. I'm not entirely certain.
What do you mean?
Oh, yeah.
I think Sam Raimi was picked for a directing choice for something else in phase one or early phase two. I'm not certain.
Oh, that's a fun coincidence.
And did he do a Spider-Man movie? Maybe a fan film?
What the hell are you talking about?
I'm being facetious and a dick.
Okay, well.
Hold on, now I'm looking up Sam Raimi on the Jonah Wiki. Well, shout out to Jonah.
Shout out to Jonah. I actually did use the wiki a lot when I was writing this because I couldn't remember the episodes very much.
The wiki comes in hella clutch, I'm telling you.
It is wonderful.
Shout out the has to do with Spider-Man, I think, wiki.
Be sure to check it out. It's always linked in our description. We love Jonah. And also, Jonah character mention. Swiss Miss. Molly
Yeah.
Dante.
There's a few names that have come up here. We've had Fancy Dan back from the dead and then immediately dead again. We got Swiss Miss mentioned, Janine Godby, which would be Hallows Eve. And so I like the choices of the characters that you're using to noirify.
Yeah, the spider is such a specific character. I knew that I needed villains that it felt like he could have organically fought in his own book. So spooky metal witch and weird Halloween lady felt pretty apt.
Oh yeah.
That's fair.
Jarrett, Sam Raimi has not been used unless you count the Raimi trilogy of Spider-Man movies.
He might have been on the in the running for something else.
What you might be thinking about is in the Spider-Man minus Spider-Man plus Garfield episode, we did say that it could be I can't even finish it with a straight face. The Raimi movies, all three of the Raimi movies completely being redone. Peter Parker and Spider-Man are both cut out and then just crudely dropped on top as Garfield of the hit
Wait, what
cast.
Raimi movies? Are you talking about like Send Help? I know that's new.
Oh, Spider-Man, Spider-Man 2, Spider-Man 3.
No, man, that was Mark Webb.
Oh, that's right.
I don't know how
Yeah.
you mix those
No,
two up,
wait.
but whatever.
Fuck. Yeah, I'm talking about.
I thought
Oh,
Mark
man.
Webb did Evil Dead.
Yeah,
No, that was
wait.
Fede Alvarez.
Oh. Oh, God, the kayfabe's messing with my head. Can we
Do you
get
guys
back
have
into
like a gas leak or something?
this? I smell sulfur.
There might be a gas leak in this apartment.
It's starting to smell of sulfur.
I assume you all sleep in like a big bed, like Charlie Brown's grandparents, or Charlie Bucket.
Yeah.
Fuck, fuck. Let's continue. Let's. The next scene opens on a figure entering a massive, dilapidated manor, passing through rooms that haven't been cleaned in a decade or more. It's less Wayne Manor and more Dracula's castle. The windows are mostly boarded up, but the sun is rising and a few rays of honey-colored light stream through the gaps. The man gradually removes articles of clothing, sets his violin aside, and eventually peels off layers of facial prosthetics before arriving in what was once a dining hall and is now a makeshift war room. Close-up of his gray eyes as they dart around a map of New York City, zeroing in on West 42nd Street. We finally get a good look at his face, revealing Richard Wentworth, played in the film by Tobey Maguire.
Whoa.
Now I cast him because there's this movie called Brothers where he plays like a psychologically scarred veteran, and I think he has like the kind of savagery and intensity that the spider demands, so.
Got it. That was the
Interestingly, this
reason.
is another Gatsby connection as well.
Oh shit, I didn't even think of that. Awesome. Did he play Nick
These are the only
Carraway?
reasons.
He was Nick,
Yes.
yeah.
Okay, I haven't seen that film. And I was so distracted by Elizabeth Debicki, like I can't focus on anything else while she's in
Fair.
eyesight. Hell of a
Valid.
woman.
So real.
God. Anyway, Richard works in absolute silence as he charts out angles of approach and escape routes, puts together a new disguise kit, and assembles his weaponry. He's about to pack up a stylized revolver when he notices the cylinder is catching. After several minutes, he can't find the source of the issue, so he picks up one of those old-fashioned candlestick phones. Whenever he's not doing an impression, his natural voice comes out as a cracked whisper, as if it's damaged from disuse. Professor Brownlee, one of my air guns seems to be jammed, and I have a mission of vital importance coming up. How soon can you come by and fix it? The voice on the other end sounds warm and amicable. It feels distinctly out of place amidst this moldering mansion and its joyless inhabitant.
Golly, Richard, I haven't heard from you in ages. I was starting to get worried. I got a gig working at a machinist shop on the waterfront. I could swing by during my lunch break around 1 p.m.
Good. Richard hangs up without saying goodbye. After lurching over to a nearby couch, he rests his arms over his chest like a mummy and closes his eyes. We hold on this shot. There's a knocking sound at the door, and his eyes immediately fly open. The sunbeams are brighter and angled different, indicating the passage of time. Richard rises to his feet and opens the door, ushering in Professor Brownlee. Now, this is a Sam Raimi movie, and Brownlee is probably the most normal, well-adjusted character in the script, so he'll be played by Bruce Campbell.
Yes. Jesus, Richie, you doing okay? It looked like you just got pulled out of the Hudson.
I'm fine. Brownlee pauses, waiting for Richard to ask him how he's doing, but he just stands there. Brownlee awkwardly moves on.
So, what seems to be the problem?
Richard tries to rotate the cylinder, but it keeps catching. Brownlee goes to take a look at it.
Been a while since I serviced this. Probably just some swarf buildup.
The professor applies some sort of machine oil and slowly works it into the mechanism. Brownlee tries to break through Richard's icy exterior.
Listen. I appreciate you helping me out with those blackmailers a few years back. It really saved my bacon, and I hope you won't think I'm overstepping or anything, but are you okay? You seem even more dour than usual.
My job demands a hefty moral toll. Paying it is costly, but I manage.
Don't get me wrong, you've saved a lot of lives, including mine, but all this violence and secrecy, surely there's some other way to go about it.
Richard shakes his head. There are lines the cops won't cross. Torture, taking prisoners, drugging captured opponents, planting evidence to ensure a conviction, and here pause for jeering laughter from the audience. The legal system has more holes than a cobweb, and as the spider, I can easily navigate those gaps, protect the rest of the web.
Sure, but what about that Spider-Man guy? He doesn't kill people.
Well, maybe if he did, he wouldn't have gone missing. He was probably some well-intentioned simpleton who wanted to follow my lead and got himself killed. The professor frowns as he finishes servicing the revolver.
At least he swung around on webs. You just shoot people. What kind of spider does any of that?
Thank you, Professor.
Maybe one of these days we can sit down, have a drink. I know it's been hard, but Nita...
Richard turns to stare at Brownlee. Or rather, he stares through Brownlee. Don't ever say her name in front of me. The professor can tell he struck a nerve and quickly packs up his things to leave.
Okay. Good luck with everything, Richard. Stay safe, yeah?
We linger on Richard as we hear retreating footsteps and a door closing. Richard looks down at his newly repaired pistol, staring into the barrel, and we slowly pan in on its abyssal darkness, eventually arriving at a full black screen. The camera slowly zooms out, revealing the dark eyehole of a decorative mask. We see an entire crowd of masked revelers lining up for entry into a high society masquerade. The front of the hotel is covered in banners and signs that say, "Madame Trixie's Masquerade Ball." Richard watches the spectacle from across the street, equal parts amused and frustrated. So, I have to find and interrogate a target who's attending a masked ball. There's always something. He crosses the street and tries to gain entry anyways, but the bouncers turn him away. Fortunately, Richard knows New York City like the back of his hand and heads for a costume store a few blocks away. When he gets there, inventory is sparse. I just need a last-minute costume. Are you sure you don't have anything in the storeroom? The store manager shrugs. I can try, but inventory is low. After 10 minutes of diligent searching, she comes back with a ratty old mask in her hand. I don't even know what this one's supposed to be, maybe a scarecrow or something, but it's yours for a dollar. Richard pays and leaves, and we follow him from behind as he makes his way back to the party. He puts the mask on as he approaches, and all we can see of it is wiry, almost straw-like hair, which sticks out in every direction. Once it's on, the camera orbits Richard's head until we see it from the front. It's wide-eyed and gaunt, with deep wrinkles and pronounced cheekbones. Whenever Richard is wearing the mask, he's played and voiced by Willem Dafoe.
Okay.
In the spider novels, there's this kind of like Jekyll and Hyde thing going on where the spider is like a persona that Richard dons, and it becomes kind of unclear who's like the real person. So I decided to cast a whole nother actor, and Willem Dafoe already looks like a Halloween mask, so
he
gets the part.
That's a really funny detail.
So I always like to ask this, especially if Willem Dafoe is showing up in something. On the Willem Dafoe to Willem Dafriend scale, where would you put this depiction of Willem Dafoe on? Willem Dafoe being most evil Willem you've ever seen, Willem Dafriend being the most kind, sweetest Willem.
Okay, so my thinking is the spider's arc in this is that he basically goes from being the Punisher to the Creeper.
Okay.
So there's like, I guess he's evil, he like kills people and whatever, but he's like, he's having a good time, and is that really such a bad thing?
No, not a bad thing, no.
Exactly.
Ain't nothing wrong with a little bit of murder. Yeah.
I'm always
on the Willem Dafriend side of things.
Yeah. Jared, if you were played by Willem Dafoe, you would be like Willem the enemy. You.
The enemy?
Willem the op. Alrighty, let's continue.
Thank you.
How do you guys get anything done?
It's me, on me. I don't know. Jesus, it's always Christ. Me.
We love you, Andy.
Hi, Andy. Sorry for making your job harder.
We love you.
Okay, back to it. The doorman looks at this new partygoer and invites him inside. Richard scans the room, but to no avail. In a crowd like this, he wouldn't be able to recognize his own mother. We get a few scenes of him unsuccessfully fishing for information, and eventually he'd do some sort of sneaky, clever infiltration to find the hotel manager's ledger and find Jeannie's room. Richard passes by drunken revelers as he reaches behind his back and discreetly unholsters his pistol. When he arrives at her door, he puts an ear to it and listens carefully. He doesn't expect to hear anything, but the sound of a faint struggle is audible within. With lightning speed, he pulls a set of hidden lockpicks out of his wristband and unlocks the door, bursting inside with his gun drawn. Sure enough, Janine Godby is inside, and since this is a multiversal variant, she's played by Rachel Brosnahan this time. I didn't actually know who the actress was who plays her in the main has to do canon, and she's like young, and I felt weird about putting a young actress in these scenarios, so I went with Brosnahan. Sorry, guys.
All good.
She was apparently getting ready for the ball downstairs, and her full body costume is made entirely out of masks, with different colors and materials giving it a disorienting look. But there's a man in there with her, an intense looking Desi man in formal wear and a turban, pressing a dagger into her neck. End of Act One.
I like this.
We're in a good spot here. I really like the noir tone that is being used.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the tropes of that whole genre. I really like going with the pulpy idea to have the mask be an entirely different character. That's a fun,
mm-hmm.
fun idea.
I agree.
It took me way too long to remember that Rachel Brosnahan was Dalton's original pick for Janine Godby.
Yeah, we chose...
We swapped for the...
I think she's in Heated Rivalry or something, which I still haven't seen.
Sophie...
Like not... Thessaly or something?
So Sophie Nalisi? Nalisi?
I think that's Nalisi? I don't know. Brosnahan is much easier to pronounce, so I'm going with that one.
Sophie Nestle, heir to the Nestle Corporation. Not actually, it's Nalisi.
I'm gonna DM her on Twitter and ask why she thinks it's okay to like charge pregnant women for like drinking water or whatever.
Oh gosh, Jarrett, we can't get into it. Nestle's a bad company, but their chocolate milk is all right.
Oh, you mean the chocolate company? Yes, I know that. I was like, what does she have to do with anything?
Let's get into Act Two. I'm really enjoying this.
Okay. Oh, I should warn you ahead of time. I did not actually finish Act Three, so we're gonna have to like spitball together. Whoops.
Valid. That's
fine. It's the Jarrett method. We roll.
Okay. Thank God.
Check Jarrett method.
Act Two. Richard puts his hands in the air cautiously. When he speaks, it's in Willem Dafoe's voice. Easy now. Who are you and what do you want with the girl? When the man speaks, he barely moves a muscle. He's a picture of perfect stillness. I think he'd either be played by Ram Charan from RRR.
Phenomenal movie.
Oh my god, it's so good. I watched it the other day and I was like twitching from just overstimulation. That's what she said. Or Shahzad Latif from Penny Dreadful.
I am Ram Singh. Do not be alarmed. This woman may look harmless, but she is a criminal and a patricide. I simply need information from her, and then she will be delivered to your police.
And what information would that be?
I have reason to believe she is an associate of Neely Fasal, an American whose witchcraft permits her to control metal.
Neely Fasal? If she's a witch who controls metal, I think we're looking for the same person. I know her as Molly Lee Dante.
Janine recognizes the name and makes a subtle gesture while her hand hangs loose at her side. One of the masks on her costume, a gargoyle located on her right shoulder, shimmers and transforms as it mystically comes to life. The gargoyle bites down hard on Rom's knife arm, forcing him to release his blade, and she takes advantage of the chaos to free herself from his grasp. She snarls and turns to face her two would-be interrogators.
I would never betray High Priestess Dante. She saved my life.
Janine gestures again, producing glowing runes, and more of her masks come to life. With dozens of braying, biting heads, she almost resembles the Hecatoncheires of Greek myth.
She also instructed me in the mystical arts, the same arts I'll be using to strip the flesh from your bones.
She charges at Richard, trying to make a break for it. He's usually pretty unflappable, but this would disorient anyone. Janine takes a swing at him, and a lion's head engulfs her hand, lunging at Richard with inch-long fangs. He dives backward and braces himself on the ground before diving for a kick below the lion's jaw. Its head snaps up painfully, and its weight throws Janine off balance. Richard kicks again, aiming to take out her legs, but a fish mask on her leg becomes a barracuda-like fish with serrated teeth, and his foot spasms to the side before it gets the chance to bite him. Ram is too injured to meaningfully fight back, but he kicks at her leg from behind where it's still unprotected. Janine is forced to her knees, but a swordfish manifests on her lower back, nearly impaling Ram. All three fighters are on the ground, but Janine has advantages the other two don't. A dragon mask on her stomach comes to life, and when it opens its mouth, a sickly glow and sulfuric smell fill the room. Richard manages to get a shot off, and the dragon falls dead, its head sagging limply. A lizard mask on her knee comes to life, and its long tongue yanks the gun out of Richard's hands. Rom grabs the swordfish's snout, using it for leverage to lift himself up, snatch the gun from midair, and shoot Janine in the back of the head. She falls to the ground with a heavy thud, covered in the heads of recently alive animals. Rom and Richard look at each other incredulously until the latter bursts out laughing, giving us a classic Willem Dafoe cackle.
What could possibly be so funny?
I have no idea. I think the adrenaline's wearing off.
This is no laughing matter. If we are truly after the same foe, she was our only source of information.
The reminder sobers up the spider.
Damn, you're right. We should get out of here. I have no idea how to explain any of this to the police.
There's a tavern nearby called the Storm and Crow. We should meet there and discuss what we know.
The spider chokes back laughter as he glances at the bizarre cadaver on the floor.
Good idea. I'm sure Janine would agree that two heads are better than one.
We cut to the Storm and Crow, where Rom and Richard have taken a table in a dark corner, away from prying eyes. Richard takes the opportunity to remove his mask.
I never caught your name.
You can call me the Spider.
Very well. Why do you seek Neely Fazal? Or Molly Lee Dante, if you prefer.
She killed someone very close to me. I have nothing left in my life but revenge.
She slew someone close to me as well. There was a bank robbery in London. My wife was merely buying groceries. A passerby who was simply in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Richard startles at that.
I remember. November 1931. I say she was my fiancée, but I never saw myself living long enough to tie the knot. I've been a vigilante for years, and every night out on patrol could have, maybe should have, been my last. Because if I had, she wouldn't have offered to go to the bank and cash a check for me.
The two men sit in tense silence, stewing in memories of perceived failure. Rom breaks the silence.
We should focus on what we know. Combine our resources to seek out the Dante woman. What do we know for sure?
She's originally Swiss. Picked up some kind of mystical training in Europe. Mostly uses it to travel the world and commit crimes. Only known associate is one Janine Godby, now deceased.
Aren't there a handful of magicians in New York? Perhaps one of them knows more.
Houdini is long dead. You mean Mysterio? Everyone knows he's a humbug. They think for a second. Rom has an idea.
I will admit, the science of magnetism is beyond me. But isn't magnetism the property which attracts a compass needle? Perhaps there's an engineer in New York who can build a machine that can track her.
Yes, I believe I know just the man. I can introduce him to you tomorrow. Meet me at this address at 9 a.m. He gives Rom his address and the two men shake hands before departing. The next day, Rom arrives at Wentworth Manor. Richard invites him in, and the Sikh looks around skeptically at the ruin and decay.
Are you called the Spider because you live amongst cobwebs?
No, it's because the legal system has more holes than a spider web and... Oh, never mind.
Why do you dwell within these ruins?
My family came to America on the Mayflower. We built this country, built us railroads, forged its steel. This house and myself are all that remain of them.
But surely you're fortunate enough to repair it.
Many times over. But I feel more at home surrounded by these forgotten relics than I ever would amongst luxury. There's a knock at the door, and Professor Brownlee shows up again.
So, what's this I hear about a super compass?
He spots Rom and smiles.
Hey, you made a friend. That's great. How'd the two meet?
We were pursuing the same target for interrogation. She had mystical powers, which enabled her to animate the masks she wore all over her body. I was nearly impaled by a swordfish.
Right.
Then they do a bunch of science shit where they figure out the compass construction and everything. Brownlee manages to design one that isn't drawn to a magnetic pole, but one that responds to changes in magnetic fields. There's just one problem. It can be assembled on the ground, but due to the complexities of the mechanism and the sensitivity of its components, it will need to be activated 1,204 feet in the air. The three of them struggle to come up with a solution until Richard has a realization.
How tall is an individual floor of a building, Professor?
14 feet for commercial buildings. Why do you ask?
Richard does some quick napkin math and smirks in satisfaction.
All we need is a building that's got an 86th floor, and I've got the perfect one in mind.
He walks over to a window and throws open the curtain, revealing the Empire State Building in the distance. The professor spends the next few hours constructing the rudimentary components while Richard and Rom work out a plan to infiltrate the Empire State Building. Richard applies another set of facial prosthetics for a disguise, but after seeing himself in the mirror, he keeps adding new layers and flourishes until he has an exact replica of his Willem Dafoe Halloween mask from earlier. When he sees it, Rom is visibly put off.
If you're going to wear a disguise, why would you choose one that's so recognizable?
I don't know. Something about it soothes me. It's like slipping out of a straitjacket and into silk pajamas.
Once the sun is finally set, the two of them make their way towards the Empire State Building. As they enter it, a cab driver takes notice of them, and once they're out of view, he gets out of his cab and uses a nearby phone booth. Using a combination of sneaking past guards, lying to doormen, and posing as janitors, they manage to schmooze their way up to the 86th floor. It's pretty sparse, just an observation deck and an office for the Hidalgo Trading Company, so they manage to assemble the Super Compass without issue. They watch in nervous anticipation as it slowly boots up, and after some quick ticking, the needle immediately pivots.
Which direction is it pointing?
That's west. We should be able to track her from here.
The two men pack up the compass, which is the size of a lunchbox, and take their leave. It's a beautiful night in Depression-era NYC, and the duo walk through the streets, illuminated by gas lamps.
Surely you don't expect to walk back to your house.
Nope, but we're being tailed, and I want to know who's following me and what they want.
I see. Shall we find somewhere private so that we might converse with them face to face?
Let's shall.
Okay, can we pause here? I gotta get more water.
Go for
it. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, cool. Be back in two shakes. Okay, Daddy's home. What did I miss?
We were talking about how, like, having multiversal stories like this, where it's period pieces or different takes on the universe outside of the main Sony Pictures universe of Marvel characters slash the shit that we're doing, is, like, very interesting and might actually help with some of our future planning. So... yeah, this is really cool. We're really excited.
It opens up the gates even more for people who want to, like, play in this world. Be like, if somebody was like, oh, I want to do Kraven. It's like, actually, that Kraven's in a movie, or Doc Ock is doing this thing. Somebody else can write a whole nother just Doc Ock movie, and it's in a different universe. It's simple as. I think that works very well, and it's a good idea to expand.
My, like, favorite go-to multiverse story to this day is The Dark Tower. And that's because they treat every new universe like every time a character arrives, they have to, like, figure out the rules, figure out, like, society. It's like, if you go to another country, it can feel like an alien planet. Going to an actual, like, alternate world would be, like, completely foreign. You'd have, like, no basis. So, like, you need that kind of wild imaginative spark.
I love
something like Multiverse of Madness, where it's called Multiverse of Madness, but the biggest change is that, like, Stephen Strange wears a different color robes.
And green means stop.
And red means go.
Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ. That's like one of the only movies I left the theater for. Actually, you know what? Screw it. Sam Raimi isn't allowed to direct this one.
Damn.
Bring in Mark Webb.
For you.
For you.
They casually saunter into an alleyway and prepare for combat. Minutes later, several old-timey gangsters follow them in, accompanied by a massive man in a yellow turtleneck. This is the Noir Universe version of Ox, played by Peter Claffey. Okay, side note. I was watching Night of Seven Kingdoms, and I looked at Peter Claffey, who plays Dunk, and I'm like, wow, this guy would really do a good job playing Ox. And I was reading this, and I was like, oh, I can, like, utilize him. And, you know, Terry Crews is kind of old anyway. And then I thought, like, 10 minutes ago about the logistics of recasting the only other person of color in the cast aside from Rom, so I'm not racist. I just wanted to differentiate this from the has to do with Spider-Man. I think multiverses should be different. I was just explaining that.
On God.
On God. Black Lives Matter. Okay.
There you are. I've been tearing the city apart looking for
you. Wasted your time. If you're a criminal in this city, I would have sought you out eventually.
Not you. I have no idea who you are. I'm in him.
He points a hot dog-sized finger at Rom, who startles a little.
I visited Montana in the hospital. Says a guy in a turban was asking about some broad. When he got what he wanted, he left him for dead. That's gotta be you. Bet you're the one who killed Fancy Dan, too.
No, that was me. I branded him with a spider so people would know who killed him. I guess you weren't smart enough to figure that out.
Ox sizes up the spider.
I thought the spider had a fedora and a trench coat.
That's Spider-Man. Totally different guy. I was here first.
You don't look anything like a spider. You're just a guy with a weird face. Maybe if I squash you like a spider, your name will make more sense. Kill him, boys!
What follows is a truly chaotic fight. Rom and the spider would have no problem holding their own against a half dozen human gangsters, but they have to keep passing the compass back and forth so it doesn't get damaged, and dodge Ox's super strong blows. If I had to make a comparison, it's like the fight choreography in the latter half of The World's End. There's a few close calls where the compass almost gets smashed, but our heroes eventually persevere. Ox is the last villain standing, and the two of them deliver a perfectly choreographed beatdown, dodging to and fro and delivering shallow cuts. Fittingly, they take him down the same way a matador would slowly bleed out an ox. Ox sinks to the ground, bleeding from dozens of shallow cuts. He looks up at the two of them, his eyes burning with hatred.
You sons of bitches! You think you can take out the enforcers with no consequence? The Magia runs the city. If I don't return alive, Hammerhead will send his entire army of killers after you.
That's not necessarily true. You're a pretty dumb guy. He'll probably think your death is an accident.
What?
With a single fluid motion, the spider slits his throat with a dagger, elegantly stepping aside to avoid the resulting spray of blood. Once the bleeding stops, he takes out his lighter and brands Ox, just like he did with Fancy Dan and countless other mobsters before him.
Why do you make such stupid jokes? I cannot tell whether you're dedicated to your cause or losing your mind.
I don't know. Usually I just use prosthetics, but for some reason having a mask is really freeing. Maybe that's why Spider-Man does it.
That is likely why Janine Godby did it, too. Perhaps you prefer a different face because you can no longer bear to look at your own anymore. You must take care not to lose yourself, Mr. Wentworth.
The spider considers this and peels off the Willem Dafoe mask, wadding it into a ball and tossing it in a storm drain as they leave the alleyway. Come on, we'll start searching for Dante first thing in the morning. You can sleep at my place tonight. The two men head off for Wentworth Manor and we fade to black. End of Act 2.
The spider no more.
Oh, fuck, I should have had him wadded up and thrown into a trash can. Damn it. Oh, that's so obvious. Damn
that's
it.
Canon.
It's canon.
Okay,
though.
Yeah, that's the studio notes. Directly from Sony, who's sponsoring this podcast.
No.
Wait.
Oh, God.
Oh, my God. Why did I cast fucking Willem Dafoe? This is such a hard voice to do.
Admittedly, you're doing a very good job.
You're doing a really good job at it, yeah.
Immediately, I was like, oh, that's Dafoe.
My upcoming El Don pitch is not carried, but certainly buoyed by the fact that I have like two really good impressions of two very famous comedians that I didn't know I could do until I tried them. So keep a lookout for that one. They also killed my voice. Go figure.
I love how both of my roles were just really fun bit parts who proceeded to make an impression and then die violently.
I mean, that's kind of how every pulp book is. It's like you've got this really fun, memorable character, and then like the protagonist just tortures them to death. Oh, whoever's doing the Rom voice, I keep getting you guys mixed up, but whoever's doing Rom, perfect. That's exactly how I like heard it in my head.
Thank you.
Good job, Noah. Out of applause for Noah.
Good job, Noah.
I have had professional voice work roles, so.
Have you?
Huh?
Yeah, I've done it. Why did done I not know this? Past.
I mean, if you guys have made any money on Patreon, then you're all by definition professional voice actors, so.
Damn. You're right.
Damn.
Wow.
Act 3. We open in the bedroom of an upscale apartment building. A woman standing in front of the minibar pours herself a complicated martini. The bed behind her is well used, its sheets still disheveled from last night's tryst. She raises her glass to her lips, and we see that she's played in the film by Kirsten Dunst of The Virgin Suicides. She takes a sip of her drink, and there's a knock at the bedroom door.
Come on in.
The door opens, and Richard Wentworth enters. He looks and sounds healthier than he has at any point in the movie. That same intensity is there, but his face is fuller, and there's a little more color in his skin. Sorry for working on one of our vacations, but I caught wind of an opium smuggling ring and decided to lend a hand to Scotland Yard.
I'm sure they'll appreciate a pile of dead bodies with spider brands on their foreheads.
It's the gift that keeps on giving. He leans in for a kiss, and the woman puts a finger on his lips to stop him before wiping away a drop of blood from his face.
You're not usually this careless.
I've been distracted as of late.
Oh? Distracted by what?
You'd love her. She's whip-smart, determined, has great games. He leans in for his long-awaited kiss, smiling as he pulls away. What can I say? I just can't stop thinking about my mistress. Nita laughs.
Oh, please. Richard Wentworth is the farthest thing in the world from a womanizer. I don't know what you'd do with yourself if I left the picture.
Richard frowns. My whole life it was like I was living underground. Meeting you was like seeing the sun for the very first time. I don't like to think of what my life would be like if you weren't in it. Nita softens and rubs his arm reassuringly.
You won't ever have to. You're the hardened vigilante, after all. I'm just a socialite. I'll definitely outlive you.
That's true. You'll probably be playing snooker with Cary Grant before my body is cold.
Cold? You didn't even wait till you were dead. I was going to head to the bank. Any checks cashed?
Yes, actually. Thanks, darling. He hands her a check and watches fondly as she leaves the room. The instant she shuts the door, his eyes fly open. He's back in the present, looking borderline sickly again, roused from his sleep by a loud rattling that emanates throughout the house. Rom bursts into his room.
Is this an earthquake?
No. He looks around and realizes that the rattling is only affecting metal objects. They clatter and whine and ring out, getting louder and louder, until they suddenly stop altogether. The house is still again. There's a knock at the door, and Richard and Rom look at each other in trepidation. They pull out their weapons and slowly creep towards the front door. When they open it, a woman is standing there. Her outfit is pieced together with garments from all around the world, with metal jewelry throughout. Piercings, chains, heavy baubles, all in shades of metallic blue and gray. She's carrying what looks like a broomstick, but there's a scythe on the other end. She's played in the film by Bryce Dallas Howard.
Mm.
Okay, and this is where I ran out of time to do the script. So the idea is the compass doesn't just notice, it doesn't like detect magnetic fields, but Swiss Miss can like detect it somehow. And so it draws her to the Wentworth Manor. And then the third act would be like a big fight where it's like Richard and Rom in a house full of metal weapons that they're good at, but that are being used against them. I don't know who wants to contribute. Let's spitball this thing.
Mm. So this is the first time that we're actually meeting. I'm blanking on the name.
Swiss Miss.
This is the first time we're actually meeting her in this script.
Yes.
Like we haven't checked in on her at all before now.
Yeah, she's like the looming threat, and then she appears very suddenly.
Got it. Okay, cool.
Mm. Hmm.
So this is our third act. This is our climactic final battle here.
Yes.
Okay. First thing that's coming to mind is that considering like reminding myself of like in the films how Magneto has been portrayed in the past, especially the more recent movies like Days of Future Past, Dark Phoenix, though that era, a lot of the ways that Magneto would utilize the powers was like with smaller objects and just how deadly like something as simple as a coin can be or like just a small metal ball. So I'm envisioning her like taking out the piercings and being able to like send them flying through the room like daggers that are like like heat-seeking daggers that can like loop and twist around in the room.
I was thinking of ways to differentiate her from Magneto, and one of them is that her scythe broomstick is her like main mode of travel. Like for whatever reason, she's just like really good at balancing on it, and she can like fly around like really fast. And because this is like an ancient like manor, I figure it's probably full of like, you know, battle axes and like suits of armor and like the mounted shields and everything. So maybe it's that she can't like use metal quickly, like she can't turn anything into like a storm of bullets, but she can like use things with the speed that a normal person could. But because she's in a house full of weapons, she's like extra, she's like in her element pretty much.
Okay. I think because they already have the super magnet, right? The super compass.
Yeah, it's not like it doesn't have like any like purpose other than like as a compass. It can't like create an EMP or anything, I don't think.
Okay, I was gonna say, is there something that they could do with that to kind of like counteract the magnetism, but sort of like supercharge it and sticker to it, or like, I don't know, like turn the magnetism against her somehow?
Well, my thinking is that Richard and Rom would like kind of set up like swords, like she would like try and summon them and they'd like point them at her so they like fly at her, and then she has to like dodge that, if that makes sense.
Okay.
And I feel like the final like, and this is like something I came up with in the shower where I like didn't have time to actually write it down, but like maybe the final blow is like she's dispatched Rom or like pinned him under a bunch of swords or something, and she's like towering over Richard, and there's like a shattered photo of Nita nearby, and he stares at that, and then we cut to like her entering the room and like mocking him, and then when she like gets in close to like, you know, deliver the final blow, he's got a pane of glass from the photograph between his teeth, and he like just jerks his head up and like sticks it in her throat.
Mm. Mm.
That would feel very in line with the noir styling. I like that.
Mm. Yeah, I feel bad. I've brought such a like a vile movie onto your show.
It's okay. We just had. Are you fully caught up with the?
I think so. The Solo was the last one I watched.
Right.
Right. Yep.
Oh, that's true. You guys went all out with Carnage. I'm in good company. You're all sociopaths. Yeah.
We just had Carnage tongue skull fucking Danny McBride.
Danny McBride's brain.
Yeah.
Insane scene.
I'm kind of thinking.
I feel like it has to be whatever the key device is of her undoing has to have been set up prior. Like it's something that they were either inadvertently using or carrying around with them throughout that becomes important in the final battle. That's super magnet, because that was something that they were building and figuring out and using throughout Act 2.
Well, there were like a ton of retcons I wanted to make with this. If I had like an extra day, this thing would be like so like bright and shiny for you guys. But this was very short notice and I had like some personal things coming up. So it was it's okay. It was just a bit of a rush. But I was thinking maybe there's like a photograph of Nita that he has like in his war room that he like keeps covered up that he can't bear to look at, but he keeps like glancing at it, and like Professor Brownlee notices, and maybe that's where he gets the shard of glass from, as he shatters this portrait of the woman he loves, and that's his way of like accepting that she's gone. He's like overly precious about it, but then he like has to break it just to have a non-metallic blade to use.
I think that works very well.
You know what it's gotta be. Part of it is when Professor Brownlee makes him the compass, he like pulls Richard aside and goes like, hey, you know, this job is hard enough. Like, why not help yourself out with the branding? And he like shoves something into his hands. And then Richard uses it during the final battle. And it's like a net that's woven out of like super strong material. It's his spider's web.
Ooh.
Mm.
So that like buys him the time he needs at like some crucial point.
I like that.
Is the brander, can she try attempt to use that at some point? Like, is that made out of like iron or something magnetic?
Actually, it's interesting you say that, because in the novel, because I only had time to read one spider book, so sorry to the like one surviving spider fan from like 1947, but the novel actually does specify it's made out of platinum, so I think you could probably do a thing of like, oh, her powers only work on like ferrous material, and there's not enough of it in this lighter to whatever.
Mm. Yeah, I think if that's another thing that's been used throughout that we've set up as a like reoccurring device that I think could be her undoing. Like maybe she tries to use the brander on him and it doesn't work because it's like not magnetic for some reason. And that's what gets her close enough to him to be able to like
use it on her for
the killing blow.
Yeah, that's good.
I feel so silly because all that I keep thinking about is particularly in a way to defeat Swissmas is And they did this to defeat Magneto in the comic books. Like, Iron Man made his costume out of wood or something. Like, and so my brain is like, oh, what if they just use, like, a slingshot, like a wooden slingshot?
Thinking quickly, the Shadow assembles an entire suit of wooden armor out of some scraps in the war room.
You cannot defeat me now. I'm Wood Man from Mega Man. Yeah, that does not work.
No, it doesn't.
Y'all are having really good ideas in my brain. Going back to slingshot and wood armor.
I like the idea of her having a real problem with the brander, just because that's been something that's...
Actually, yeah, what if platinum is like her kryptonite, just because it's like such a rare material? I could even throw in a line about how she like robbed a bank but left all the platinum bullion behind or some damn thing. Okay, we're onto something.
And then like, she's like, why can't I figure this out? And she's like... Like it's a proximity thing. Like she's trying to get closer to it so that she can manipulate it. That's what closes the distance enough for him to make a killing blow, whether it be with the shard of glass or with the brander itself.
Yeah, that's a really good idea. I hadn't thought of that. You kind of understand how the spider wasn't necessarily like, he didn't have a long life like the Shadow or Doc Savage did, because he's like, he's a vigilante, but his like signature move is shooting people with a gun.
Mm-hmm.
And no real spider-like qualities.
It's very funny to me. It's,
I think naturally, because of that, and Peyton and I discussed this very briefly during we had a break moment, because obviously I'm assuming that this ends with her dead, correct?
Oh yeah, no one survives the spider. Actually, that'd be a better tagline than anything they came up with in the novels. Shit, they should pay me for that.
There's earlier it's talked about that Spider Noir, because it's the same, seemingly the same Earth as Spider Noir exists in, that we see.
I was thinking that this takes
filmed.
Place either at the same time as or slightly before Into the Spider-Verse, and the reason that Spider-Man is missing is because he's on Miles Morales' Earth.
That's cool. What Peyton and I had been talking about. I said, I wonder if that's if he's not here because Into the Spider-Verse is happening when this takes place.
Yeah. I should have clarified that more.
And so naturally, at the end, Nick Cage's Spider-Noir shows back up and they have like a very like just short, heated conversation where he's just like, hi, hello, still killing people, still not killing people. Okay, get out of my face.
I do have an idea for a post-credit scene once we feel confident about Act 3, which I think is pretty good so far.
Mm-hmm.
I just picture like this madcap chase between, it's almost like a haunted house movie in the third act, and we all know Sam Raimi excels at those.
Oh, yes.
Oh, for sure.
A lot of twisty zooms or...
Oh, yeah.
What do we think, what happens with Rom by the end?
Like at the end of the fight or the end of the movie?
At the end of the movie, what are you thinking for like Rom's part in this?
I think that the spiders, because like in the comic or in the original like pulp novels, he's like a subservient like Asian butler, and that's not a good look. So I always think that they're like, they basically are two psychopathic vigilantes who simply work together to maximize their joint sleigh.
I love that. I love
that. Yeah, they're like contemporaries, and maybe like they'll go out on missions together. Like one of them will go out and the other will be like offering support. But I think it does help Richard that he simultaneously has someone that he can talk to who like relates to him. But also he has someone where he's like, okay, this guy is like a serious, like stable, quote unquote, stable presence. This gives me the opportunity to like open up a little and feel more alive as the spider.
I like that.
I like that.
Because I think like part of the reason he's been stuck is this like anhedonic, like suicidal, psychopathic vigilante is because he feels like that's what Depression era New York City needs to survive. And with Rom there, he can like relax a little, let himself breathe.
Okay. I like that. So Rom doesn't like die in the third act or something. He's intended to continue on as like a, not a sidekick, but as like a
co-lead.
Co-lead. Yeah.
And while we're on the subject of killing people off, I didn't love fridging Nita Van Sloan. Sorry. In a second draft, she would probably be alive in some capacity. That's all I got for you.
All good. Valid. Do you want to maybe do like a, I don't know. I was about to say maybe some supernatural stuff brings her back to life in a
mid-credits scene.
Mid-credits.
Because I don't, is it ever outright stated that she is dead? I think all that happened was that somebody brought up her name, and he said, don't ever say her name in front of me.
When him and Rom are at the Storm and Crow, the spider says, like, yeah, I had a fiance. She was killed at a bank robbery because she was cashing a check for me.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, maybe, like, the whole movie, it's implied that she has died. But then it's just like, no, actually, it just didn't work out, and she actually hates his guts. And so he's very upset that he just ruined hit the perfect relationship for himself.
That's the one thing that's kind of interesting about the pulp novels, is that there's this like fatalism where like they are actually engaged, but Richard does not marry her because he knows like, yeah, one day either like a gangster will get the draw on me or a cop will think I'm a criminal and shoot me in the head, and then I leave behind a widow and I can't do that, so she'll just be my fiance. Like they're under no pretense, like Richard's not making it to like 1940 or whatever. That was an interesting kind of like doomerism that I wanted to bring in.
That's cool. It's sad, but it's cool.
Right.
Like
in a second draft, I would maybe establish that she's been like manic depressive from birth, and she like feels incomplete. So when she meets Richard, she's like, oh, this guy is like dark and sour and doomed, just like I am. He's like the only one who gets me, and vice versa. This is not a feel good movie, folks.
Right. I always kind of thought that Kirsten Dunst would be good for MJ.
Nah, you know who she'd be good as? Gwen Stacy.
Ooh, yeah, yeah.
It's like she has that demure thing that I associate with Gwen more. She's not like a loud, brash party girl.
Yeah, right.
But how are you feeling about the third act, folks?
I think it's pretty interesting. I'm kind of thinking about the obviously Swiss Miss should either be like defeated or something of the sort. And then I'm kind of thinking about the aftermath more so than the how she gets defeated.
Right. Like, what happens to close us out after the fight?
Well, the aftermath, as I see it, is like Wentworth Manor is basically destroyed. So the spider has to like move. And in doing so, he has to move on. Rom becomes like his trusted confidant. Maybe they get like a house together in the East Village, you know, get a little queer coding for our LGBTs in the audience. They open together a bed and breakfast in Greenwich Village, you know, whatever.
Beautiful.
And, yeah, I think it's, like, about Richard. Like, he has this, bizarrely, the spider is his way of, like, expressing himself. It's like a, it lets him cut loose a little. And he's got Rom there as his, like, steadfast companion and co-lead. And he's, like, moved on from the death of Nita and the doomed legacy of the Wentworth family.
I like that. Cool. It kind of ends on a hopeful note.
Literally, this is as happy as a noir can possibly get.
I like that. I like that as a conclusion. You mentioned that you might have had some mid and post-credit scenes thought of.
I have, like, I guess it would be a post-credit scene, and I didn't, like, have, like, a proper, like, script and dialogue and everything, but it would be, like, Rom is out on a mission, and Richard is home alone, and a portal opens up, and a TVA agent, let's say he's played by, I don't know, Thomas Hayden Church, just throwing a name out there, he's like, all right, you are a Spider-Man variant, right? And the spider's like, would people stop comparing the two of us? I'm not a Spider-Man. I'm a spider, but... And then he, like, scans him, and he's like, I don't know, you've got some, like, weird magnetic field about you. I think there's some multiversal thing. And then because the TVA is not very efficient or good at their jobs, he's, like, somehow contrives to put the spider onto the main, has to do with Spider-Man, I think, Earth. And then he's, like, okay with that, because at this point he has nothing keeping him in his noir Earth. Rom can, like, hold down the fort, and he's got a bunch of, like, new weird characters to go after. Well, I wanted to include him in the main universe because you guys are doing an entire cinematic universe of Spider-Man villains, but there's only one Spider-Man. So I figured, like, if you ever did a pitch for, like, the Grizzly, and he doesn't really have, like, an arch enemy other than, like, Spider-Man, you can just be like, well, he looked at the spider the wrong way, and now the spider's gunning for him, and that's your antagonist. I wanted you to have, like, a free antagonist, pretty much.
It's like the scene of Eddie Brock in...
No Way Home, I think?
Or Let There Be Carnage or No Way Home, where he's, like, sitting on a beach, and...
That would be the end of Let There
Be Carnage.
He's
in the apartment, and he's, like, getting ready to be told about the hive mind, and then, like, all of a sudden, he just gets sent to another universe, and he's like, where the hell am I? And then just cut.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I wasn't sure about the, like, the magnetic field thing in the TVA. Like, I just wanted you guys to be able to use him. I don't have, like, any real strong plans on how to get him there.
I could foresee having him come into the main universe. I think we'll have to definitely talk about how.
We can specify the specifics later, but the suffice to say for one of either the post mid or post credit scene, the spider is mysteriously transported a la Eddie and Let There Be Carnage to 688B. The specifics of how or why are not explained at this time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that works.
Cool.
All right. And we even kept it under 2 hours. Look at us go, bunch of podcasting moguls.
We did.
Incredible.
All righty. Well, to wrap it up, Richard, thank you so much for coming on to the podcast and pitching us a wonderful addition into the Spider-Verse.
Call it what it is. Call it the Spunk.
The Spunk.
Spunkiverse. There you go.
This is possibly...
Thank you for your fresh deposit at the Spunk Bank.
Yeah.
Let's not call it that.
Peyton started it.
No, I didn't. It was Dalton.
Yes, you did. You were the one that said that. It was Dalton, wasn't it?
Anyways. Richard, thank you so much for coming on to the podcast. It was wonderful to get to read this and check this out. What do you have to promote?
I do have to promote my own show, Public Domain Cinematic Universe. I have a Blue Sky PDCU.bsky.social, I think it is, but I don't really use that as much. And then I just set up a Instagram, which is... Hang on, let me look it up real quick. I just set up an Instagram, which is PDCU Podcast, one word, so you can follow me there. I have a guest pitch coming up. It's a Frankenstein pitch from a friend of the show, Chris Filipowicz. Very much looking forward to that. And that'll be coming out in like mid to late April. And then on the last Saturday of the month, which I think is the 28th or 30th? The 25th. On the 25th, we've got the second ever episode, Eldon Origins, which is a contemporary reimagining of Don Quixote.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, and one last thing before I go. Swiss Miss, or I guess this version is just Molly Lee Dante. I don't ever call her Swiss Miss, but this version of Dante, she has like that broomstick with a scythe on it. And Ram Singh calls her Neeli Fasal, which is Hindi for the Blue Harvester, because she's got
I
the
fucking
scythe.
Hate fucking.
Are you serious?
Fucking hell!
Up! I'm not done. fucking Trixie's masquerade party. Trixie was the production title for Star Wars Episode 9, Rise of Skywalker. So I got another one in there for you. And then the tavern they go to after the masquerade ball, the Storm and Cloak, Storm and Crow. Yeah, Storm Crow was the production title of another Star Wars, which I do not remember. So I got three of them in there for you. You're welcome.
Oh my God.
That's
oh my
insanity.
God. You
If I had more time, I would have put like six more production title Star Wars things in there. I was so happy I've managed to find a new way of continuing to vex you.
Yes!
Nili Fasal, baby. Nili Fasal.
Is that legit? Are you legit?
I literally, yeah. Like, I specifically was like, oh, since she's like covered in metal, what if I make her kind of like off blue and she's like got a scythe because she's a harvester, and then he can call her whatever the Hindi word for blue harvest is.
Fuck it. This, literally saw blue crop in Hindi.
That's so funny.
Literally before I was even like officially invited onto the show, I was like, if I'm invited on to has to do with Spider-Man, how am I going to sneak a Blue Harvest reference? I was agonizing over this, and one of my early drafts was even, I could so clearly imagine Willem Dafoe saying, "Don't be blue, harvest time comes for us all." But like, then that was kind of done in, Carlton Drake said it. I don't remember which pitch. So someone beat me to the punch. So I had to get multilingual with it.
Oh, yes. Thank you so much.
Well, hold on. What was that groan? I thought you were happy. I was referencing your favorite movie.
Yeah, Jared, what the fuck is your problem?
Why are you being so blue, Jared?
You gotta harvest this energy.
Thank you guys so much for watching.
Be sure to follow us on the Blue Sky and on the YouTube. We are trying to get 100 subscribers by the end of 2026.
Oh shit, I gotta set up a YouTube. I keep meaning to.
It's a good outlet. What else? Patreon. We have a Patreon. It is free to join, but you can also chuck in $5 and get a bonus podcast and also like an exclusive role on the Discord, plus like a cool Discord channel that also features like predictions. Like, you can do Patreon only predictions based off of the little snippet that we include at the end of every bonus pod, sneak peeks for the upcoming episode. What else do we have? Be sure to follow us on Instagram. We're hopefully going to be using that some more. Special thanks to Jonah for the wiki, and thanks
shout out Jonah
Andy for editing the podcast,
and shout out Andy.
Thanks to Dylan Roth for the intro and outro. The outro is probably here right Dylan now. Roth. And thank you so much for listening. You.
Oh, wait, one sec. While we're still on the air, I'm doing my big Phase 1 crossover episode in July. Would you guys want to contribute voices to that?
Absolutely.
Oh, okay, yeah. Hell yeah. We can talk after.
Heck yes. All right.
That would be awesome.
See y'all.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.